Audi.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca-Nand, author, historian, comedian, podcaster and co-presenter of the Travel Podcast that doesn't actually go anywhere. That's Your Place or Mine with the wonderful Sean Keaveney. We've got Izzy Lawrence on the Big Travel Podcast. Izzy and I talk Britain's most fixable landmarks, the British Museum, jiu-jitsu fighting suffragettes, decolonising history, dinosaurs, earthworms, the slave trade, Charles Darwin, Bovril, flying solo to Australia age 6, the Moroccan side of her family and so much more.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You've got a new book coming out in January, have you?
Yes, that is Blackbeard's Treasure. This year, right? Do I call you Chessie, by the way?
Or
do
no,
I call
I'm you just Lisa. Lisa? Well, actually, cool. No, okay. People do. Yeah, it depends.
I know, well, I saw on your thing, so I thought of you as Lisa, and then I saw on your Facebook profile thing, Chessie, and I thought, oh, should I call her Chessie? And I was like, I don't. Lisa, I'll call you Lisa.
It depends what ear you know me from. A lot of people from Talk Sport still know me as Chessie, and childhood friends as well. But yeah, no, Lisa, yeah.
Okay, Lisa. Yes, there we go. Yeah, so I've got Blackbeard's Treasure coming out in January, but this year I've had 6 book deadlines. So I'm on my final one. So I am about a third of the way into the story. It's very good, it's very exciting, but I want to curl up in a ball, and my characters keep making things overly complicated when they don't need to. I keep trying to rein them in, they just go off in their own and get all upset about stuff which doesn't matter to the plot, so I have to rein them in a bit.
Yeah, characters are like that, they've got a mind of their own, haven't they?
It's so annoying, and it's particularly because I do historic fiction, so things have to happen when they happen. And if your characters are all over the place doing their own thing, it's just a, you need to get this done by this date. Otherwise, when the thing happens, you won't be ready for the next bit.
And it's not just writing a story, is it? You've got to be accurate, I'm guessing. So you have to do a hell of a lot of research.
Yeah. Yes, but it's amazing what you can actually leave out if you don't know. That is the other thing. You can just go fill it. You don't have to know exactly what type of cuffs they had in that era and what was in fashion. You can just say, he was wearing breeches. You don't need to say specifically where they buttoned or whether his socks were on the outside or the inside of the breeches. So, you know, it's that sort of stuff you can get away with not knowing.
Your work is very sort of rooted. You know, we're talking about a travel podcast, but you do have your own travel podcast for the BBC.
Yes, that's very true. But we go nowhere.
You go nowhere, exactly. I'm
Your Place or Mine. Your Place or Mine. And it stars Sean Keaveney, and I basically bully him and get the guests to, in fact, check the guests, actually. I do bully the guests quite a lot as well, because they come along and think they know where they're trying to sort of tempt Sean too, and actually they don't know any of the facts, so I have to correct them.
Is he really grumpy in real life and doesn't travel at all? I don't believe that. He's probably my favourite presenter, I'd say.
He is the sweetest, loveliest, people-pleasing hypocrite you'll ever meet. Because the thing is, like, you know, he won't go to any of these places, and he promises them he will. So the next series, I'm going to have to really sort of tackle this and say, oi, did you go to all of these places? Did you go to Taiwan like you said you would? Did that happen, Sean? And he is going to, and I know he hasn't because I follow him on Twitter. So, you know, it will be, we'll get back into the studio and he shall be shamed.
Maybe
me.
We'll join forces and we can actually go there and do a big travel
exactly,
podcast,
really sort of like, you know, underline the rubbishness that is Mr. Keaveney. So yeah, no, that's on. So it's on BBC Sounds. If you want to listen to it, it's good. I enjoy it. It's fun.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love it. And what a lovely job for you to do. But it's quite interesting actually, because a lot of your general work, your day to day work, is very much rooted in Britain, isn't it? Which, you know, the British Museum. What was the thing you did with the landmarks, which I absolutely love?
Yes, for UK TV. That was yesterday. That not as in the channel.
So that recent, was then.
Yeah, exactly. It's very happens all the time. So that was looking at the restoration of all these great landmarks, like the Royal Albert Hall. Like where else did we go to? I just remember the Royal Albert Hall because
the most memorable one.
Well, not for the actual building, which is very interesting, you know, the way it was constructed and how rubbish it was when it was first, because basically either you freeze or you bake in that building, because they gave it a glass roof, and Victoria glass roofs, you know, they're good at, you know, making greenhouses, but trying to have an orchestra in a greenhouse, not a great idea. But my favourite fact that we uncovered about that was it was the site of the first science convention. So you had like the late 19th century, so you had people doing all the sci-fi stuff, which is great, and the sci-fi drink of choice was Bovril, which is even better. And Bovril's actually is a reference to a type of drink that they were drinking in this particular sci-fi book, which is even better, the sort of beef stock hot drink. But also it's the site of the first Mr. Olympia style competition.
Well, it's sort of like a strongman sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah, but more sort of aesthetic strongman. So they weren't doing lifts, they were just posing. And so who has the most athletic body, you know, sort of bodybuilder competition. Ooh. And the person they got to judge this was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Of course.
Exactly, the writer of Sherlock Holmes. Who best to judge the aesthetic qualities of men's bodies than Sir Arthur Conan Doyle?
Which,
you know, it's just a nice... Exactly, you know, he obviously understood about, you know, symmetry and form and which parts of the muscles that it was important to be able to see and identify, I assume.
I love that about history and the history of buildings. My BA was in history of design, and the history of buildings and social and objects and, you know, how society and what was going on at the time is reflected in that. And I love the fact that you go to find out the history of the Royal Albert Hall and come back with the history of Bovril. That's particularly special.
It's also got on the outside of it, much to every paleontologist's chagrin, the guy who came up with the word dinosaur is a guy called Richard Owen. And Richard Owens was very famous and incredibly respected during his lifetime. And he's on the side pointing out a pterosaur, you know, because they've got these big murals around the side of the Albert Hall. And the thing is, everybody hated that man. So he was well respected. He was a member of the Royal Society. He was incredibly, you know, he helped put up things like the Crystal Palace dinosaurs, all of that sort of stuff. But everybody, even Charles Darwin, and you want to look at the nicest men in history, Charles Darwin is the cutest, sweetest thing you've ever met in your life. I mean, yes, he's divided the world with the theory of evolution, etc. But he also spent most of his time like playing musical instruments to worms to see if they could hear. And I'm not even joking, he used to dig in his garden for like worms and he'd bring them out and he'd play them the bassoon at them. So as a sort of scientific experiment, spent 30 years studying earthworms, was really important foundational work, found out they're important for the soil and the turning over. Anyway, the point is that Charles Darwin hated Richard Owens, and he's like the only man Charles Darwin hated. And bear in mind that Charles Darwin couldn't even get a knighthood during his time because his work was so controversial and he was, you know, completely ostracized by a large group of society. He didn't hate any of those people. He understood them. He thought they were great. Hated Richard Owens. So there you go. That's all you need to know about Richard Owens.
In fact, for the people of the, you know, the great white men of the time, and of course they were mainly men, they were actually quite harmless. But as you were saying that, it was making me think that actually it's a funny time to be an historian. I really struggle with that. I know it's the correct way of saying it, an historian. because not just because it's a funny time in history, which is a funny time in history. I think we'll look back at this period of history with something. But also, you know, the way that we're teaching history has been changing, and the way we're looking at those old figures, those once great figures, has been changing, you know, sort of decolonizing in history and you know, and seeing it through new eyes, and all the things that we were taught, for example, like the slave trade. I mean, didn't, obviously you're an historian, so you possibly knew this, but I always thought that was an American thing. It just really made me think, you know, it's us, like we were the Americans, it's us. And we've kind of like, we've sort of glossed over the fact that we were doing all that shit, you know, and now it must be a very strange time and quite a fascinating time to be involved in history and teaching and educating history.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've written a book called Blackbeard's Treasure, which was basically Bloomsbury Education sort of came to me and said, we want a book for 9 to 12-year-olds. We know, you know, you're into it. I did a show on Netflix called The Lost Pirate Kingdom, which got quite a lot of traction and that sort of thing. So they know I know about pirates. I'm like, kids love pirates. Can you do historically accurate pirates? So I've effectively written a book about the transatlantic slave trade, which is why there were pirates in the Caribbean, because basically we dumped a load of our sailors out there. We were at war with Spain, the Spanish War of Succession. After that ended, the British, we didn't have a navy. We just had a load of merchant ships that we gave these sort of what are they called? Marks of intent or something. I've forgotten the name of them. But anyway, you got given, you know, a merchant ship. You're told you can go and attack Spanish ships, and you get to keep their stuff, and you know, we'll pay you a little bit for that work. So loads of merchant ships are down in the Caribbean, and then they didn't have enough money at the end of the war to get back home and pay all their crews. So they dumped their crews off and then went back to Britain. And so the crews that were left, they couldn't get any work because all the work was being done by the African slaves who were being imported and, you know, treated absolutely terribly. I mean, the thing is, America, when they imported their slaves, was one of the few, you know, the colonies there actually tried to keep their slaves alive. And they actually had, which it sounds really callous to say, but they had breeding programs so that they were making their own slaves. And it's, you know, absolutely disgusting and horrible. I don't want to, but this is what they were doing.
Whereas, just automatically killing them.
Yeah, I mean, the Caribbean and even more Brazil, actually, they were just, it was a meat grinder. It was really horrific. You can't, I mean, this is how horrific you want to think of the transatlantic slave trade is that slavery has been about for, you know, since the dawn of time in human civilization, there's always been slavery of some sort. It's sanctioned in almost every religious text. Everybody understands there'll be slaves in society. Some people, like famous leaders, were slaves at one point. Julius Caesar famously got captured before he was a, you know, a big politician, and he basically managed to free himself and recapture the pirates who enslaved him. But, you know, slavery is just a fact of life. And it wasn't until the transatlantic slave trade that everybody went, oh my goodness, this is abhorrence. We have to put a stop to this. It was that bad that everybody thought, this makes us question the whole system itself, not just the way we're doing it. So I think it's, so to write a kid's book about that is really fun, you know, because I have to say, if you can't tell by my voice and by my, I am whiter than a toilet, right? I'm really quite, you know, racially very, very white indeed. And so it's a really sort of difficult thing to sort of go, because I want to tell the story of it. And obviously I'm going to have loads of black characters because there were loads of black pirates, you know, Blackbeard, his crew was, you know, 70%. Freed slaves. So, you know, it was a large amount of the pirates in the Caribbean were maroon slaves, were, you know, black merchants who, you know, couldn't get work. So they obviously became pirates too. So it was, yeah, it was interesting. So I have a very, you know, because things in Pirates of the Caribbean, you see black characters, but they're not the main ones. Whereas I have, like, one of my main pirate characters, real character called Black Caesar, who was an African freed slave who did fight alongside Blackbeard. And he's one of the main characters in the book. And yeah, I feel it's very important to talk about these peoples and have them imagined. But on the other hand, my main character kind of has to be a white person. Otherwise, that's going to be me telling somebody else's story in a way that I'm not comfortable
doing. It's difficult
to
unpack. I mean, people talk about telling someone else's story, but also as a writer and author and a creator, you know, often you do have to tell other people's stories. It's very difficult, isn't it? I understand you've got that sort of white guilt going on.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we should, you know, we all have that guilt. I mean, even I think, you know, everybody who's brought up under Western, you know, eyes will have that guilt about something. You know, if you're brought up in the Western culture, there is stuff that you are semi-aware of, and these prejudices that we all have. I mean, even as women, both you and I are slightly misogynistic in our outlook, because we are, because of the society we've been brought up in. It doesn't mean that we're bad, it just means we need to think about it when we start making assumptions about stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And everyone's slightly racist or prejudiced, or, you know,
homophobic and yeah, everything.
Exactly, we've been brought up with it.
Exactly. So, you know, it's a bit about forgiveness, but also about correcting yourself when you can. And the thing is, I'm pretty sure that I've done the best job I can with this book. And I'm pretty sure that a few people are just going to be going, hang on, is this right? And I'll be like, yeah, I could have done that better. But that's just the way of writing. And you can only do what you can do. It's a really fun book.
I'll get it for my kids, actually.
Excellent.
Talking of being a funny time to teach history and having to, you know, accurately represent things and not steal things and steal people's culture, you actually also do a podcast for the British Museum, which is another interesting time to be, you know, talking about, you know, the stuff that we have essentially. I say we, I'm half Indian Fijian, which is a whole other thing.
There you go. You get let off on that side then. So yeah, but that's
from
bad.
Indentured labour, and you probably know all about indentured labour, but not a lot of people do, because when the slave trades ended, we had to find other forms of labour. And then that was indentured labour. And my family were brought 4 generations ago from India to Fiji, never to go back to their homeland, like 3 other million Indians. Anyway,
loads of, you know, British Indians, you know, we call them Indians, but they come from Africa, and they come from places like Fiji. Mm. And racially, yes, you're Indian, but you actually are more familiar with the Fijian culture, the African culture. You've created a different culture there. And then you go to, you know, back to England, and you're treated like somebody from Pakistan when you've got absolutely so little in common anymore.
Yes,
it's like, you know,
very confusing.
It's like treating an English person as a Swede. It's not going to work.
Yeah. You know, mind you, I've had that a bit of in America, you know, when someone has said, oh, you're English. You know, I've got a friend who's in Switzerland. You're like, interesting. Mm. We've probably met. But what I was going to say was that, the British Museum, you know, what is in there still that we've raped and pillaged, and should we give it back, you know?
Well, yes, is the answer. We should. There's a lot of objects in there that are not, you know, shouldn't be part of the collection. There are a lot of objects in there which I think are difficult. I mean, I think, you know, the obvious one is the Elgin marbles. Mm-hmm. I think that the trouble is you've got a huge debate around this, because, for example, Elgin did buy those marbles, not for very much money and not for enough money. But there is this sort of, you know, issue with loads of objects in the British Museum. I mean, the guy, John Soane, who founded the museum. I mean, part of his wealth, the reason he was a collector, and part of it was because he married a woman who had a plantation in the Caribbean. So he was a slave owner. And so you have, you know, the very foundations of the British Museum are based in this. And to be fair to the museum, they talk about this openly. They're very open with the fact that, you know, this is what we're doing, this is where it comes from, this is why it comes from this. You know, they're very good at talking about that. And they're also very good at supporting other museums, trying to spread the objects around. So they have a lot of international projects going ahead.
We were good at looking after stuff, you know, I'll give us that, you know, although we did do the pillaging, you know, we did look after, we valued the valuable items, if that makes sense.
I mean, we do. I mean, the conservation and the project work, like they've recently, do you remember the big explosion in Beirut? And it just blew up. Well, part of the damaged goods in that was in the university there, they have a Roman glass collection. And this was in a case made out of glass. It was about, I think it was like 90 objects or something in this case. Roman glassware, very rare, very precious. And the case just fell from the wall and smashed. Mm. And the British Museum went over afterwards. They sent people over. They got some students together. They started, you know, they trained people how to, so they basically gridded out the system, picked up every single bit of glass fragments, carefully sorted them all, brought them back to the British Museum, and not just, you know, it wasn't British Museum people working there, it was people from Beirut trained now in how to conserve this glass, and they pieced it all, you know, tiny, tiny, like shattered glass fragments, pieced it all back together. So we do, you know, they've resurrected these objects from being lost forever. And so they're passing on, this is why I love the British Museum. It passes on knowledge, not just for the visitors who go there and see everything, but also they're training other cultures in the methods of conservation, in why we do things in certain ways. They're expanding the science, expanding the history. They're doing more to sort of try and find the stories behind the objects, why they were made, how they were made. And I think it's really interesting. They're doing a big redesign of the museum at the moment. And I think the people I've spoken to there are really talking about how we get these objects from behind the glass into life, how we talk about the cultures behind them, why they were created, what purposes they were created for, a bit more than, oh, that looks pretty, I like the style of that, you know, the way they've designed that. What's actually, why have they designed it in certain ways? So it's really hard. And it's also remember that, you know, when you've got sort of, you know, some objects from places like Iraq, where ISIS had been, you know, you know, decimating and
tearing
destroying
stuff up, yeah.
Exactly, you know. And also there are other places where it's very difficult to sort of give them back to, because where you're giving them back to doesn't exist anymore. So you have an object from Africa which belonged to a particular tribe, which now that tribe has been divided into two countries, and it's, you know, centuries later. Both of those peoples have a right to that object. Sometimes only one of them wants it, and that's very, you know, easy to do. But often they both have different rights. And then within that culture, you have the museums versus the governments versus the private owners. So it's incredibly difficult to find the rightful owner. You know, it's a case of, you don't want to go sawing stuff in half and seeing who says no, actually, because do you know what I mean? It's I don't envy them the task. But I do think the museum is changing in its attitudes. I do think that there are people there, like me, there are objects I find difficult that are in there, but there are a lot of objects I completely understand why they're still there. And I really respect the work the museum's doing to sort of, you know, move it on. So it's a hard question. I'm sure I've said the wrong thing in the museum.
No, I don't
just
think
be like,
oh,
that's
the museum
a terrible way. Exactly. The museum will just go, well, no, actually, because they're quite precious about, you know,
no, I love
things
it.
And mentioning it specifically.
I'm a massive fan of all of our museums. I think we do really well. And okay, we have made some mistakes in the past, but you know, we are doing it.
I mean, if you want
well.
To see
and
some real
as well,
real robbed stuff, you should go to Powers, because that's amazing. The collection of Mughal stuff there is incredible, and it literally is. It's Powers in Wales. They have Clive of India's. There's a museum there, and it's basically all the stuff that Clive of India literally looted. It's where we get the word loot from. It's an Indian word. And it's,
well,
it's
stole the word.
Exactly. But I mean, we say we, but this is private enterprise.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly,
this is,
yeah.
You know, the, this
East
is
India
the thing.
Company had a lot of, did a lot
exactly.
of damage.
Exactly. And it's a real weird confusion that I think a lot of us have. We sort of think of this as a government going out and saying, we will have this land. And it really is just private enterprise going, hi, we can get this land. Government, do you want in? Give us some money and we'll go do it for you. And it's this weird sort of like private public partnership weirdness, which it isn't how you imagine it is.
And it's,
it's less organized, and there's much less intent other than making money.
It's seeing things in the eyes of the period as well, isn't it? And I think that's kind of important.
That's
you know what,
true.
I do think I was just about to tell you about one of my favourite museum exhibits in Fiji, actually. Have you been to Fiji at all?
I have not been to Fiji.
I suggest you go. I'll tell Sean. Fiji is an incredible place, and most people sort of know it for its tropical beaches. But one of my favourite things in the Fiji Museum in the capital, which is this tiny little wonderful museum with, you know, old boats cut from canoes that people used to get there, and stuff about Captain Cook, who, of course, made his way, discovered, let's say, in inverted commas, the area. But one of the wonderful things there are the soles of the Reverend Baker's shoes after he was boiled and eaten by natives.
There we go.
I mean, they don't do that stuff anymore, you know, but yeah,
oh, interesting. Not unless you're very, very unfortunate, I'm sure.
And actually, a few years ago, the descendants of Reverend Baker went, I think they're from Southampton, they went over to Fiji and met the descendants of the people who ate the Reverend, and they all got on like a house on fire. Maybe that's a bad analogy.
I mean, that's healing, isn't it? That's yeah,
that
what we
is
like.
Healing. That is healing. I you know what? I feel we're talking about travel, are we? Are we kind of talking about Hampton? We're talking travels. Museums exactly. are travel, and history is travel.
I mean, I've since the lockdown, you know, most of my other than a few trips to France, most of my stuff is I've just been traveling UK and everything else, and going to, you know, see local stuff. And there's so much local stuff around me. I'm based in Reading, that cultural amazing place. But you know, you've got, you know, Silchester just down, which is an old Roman amphitheater that you get, you know. You could go to Rome and see the Colosseum. You could go to Silchester and shout, "Are you not entertained?" from the centre of it. And it's free. It's just literally a field, and you just park up. You know, I think the parking's free. I don't even think they charge for it. You can just go around. I'm really close to the White Horse as well, and also
that's
places like Avebury.
That,
oh yeah, it's lovely. Right. It's lovely, but nice. But you know, all of
the
these
White Horse on the hill. Yeah, I got you.
Yeah, but all of these sort of ancient, you know, sites, you know, quite close to Stonehenge as well, all of these places which really make you sort of, you know, realize what a ripple in time that we're living in. I mean, it's that sort of thing that I really enjoy about going, you know. It's why I like dinosaurs and those sort of museums as well, is because, you know, we're just a speck of life on this huge, massive, you know, millions and millions of years, billions of years in fact, long, you know, timeline of life on Earth, and we're just this tiny little blip. And I think seeing big sites, seeing mountains and stuff like that, it just makes you realize it a bit more.
So you obviously got a great passion for history. And how did you get into this stuff?
I think honestly I'm just one of these I'm one of these people who get special interests quite a lot and does deep diving quite a lot when I should be working on other things. So I actually, all it was with me, with my, you know, history career, is literally I was enjoyed doing stand-up comedy, and I am still pretty good stand-up comedian. And doing that, I was talking about my special interest, which is history. And I came up with a show called The Z-List Dead List, which you can still listen to. I'm not making new episodes, but it's very good. It's very good. About obscure people from history. And I was doing this as a live show. And simply, the British Museum, I think somebody's boyfriend listened to the show and they started listening to it. And so then I started doing it at the British Museum. And at the same time, Radio 4 was getting interested in me because, you know, I could talk about pretty much any subject that they threw at me and get very excited about it, which is always good. And so I was doing little slots of making history, that sort of thing. So it sort of built up that way. And because I'd done, you know, some writing in the past and that sort of thing, Bloomsbury sort of said to me, "Do you want to write a book about this particular radio story that I did about the jiu-jitsu suffragettes?" Because suffragettes did jiu-jitsu. And because my friend Naomi Paxton told me that. And when she told me that suffragettes were keen on their mixed martial arts, I was like, what? Why was I not taught that in school?
Yeah,
why
I need was I to talking know more about this.
Starving themselves and getting run over by horses. That was boring when I was a kid, but they actually beat up police officers and actually caused them quite serious injuries.
Yeah, so about that a little bit. I saw that you wrote a book about it, didn't you?
Once again, historical fiction. So I thought, how do you make, you know, a kid interested in women's right to vote? Because let's face it, it is not very interesting. The emancipation, like, if you're a kid, you don't get to vote anyway. So, you know, so how do you make a kid care about it? Well, what if you make her mum a suffragette and her dad a policeman? Because the reason the policemen were so violent is because the evil Home Secretary, Winston Churchill, we're talking 1910 here, right? He basically told them, don't arrest the suffragettes, because if you arrest the suffragettes, they get really pontificate-y in prison. They write letters to all the papers and we get seen as the bad guys. So instead of arresting them, just beat them up so they won't protest. And this is what, and so you have events like Black Friday, where like hundreds of women were just beat around the head and sort of left to be sexually assaulted. I don't put the sexual assault in the book, it's for kids, but you know, but I do put Black Friday in. Exactly. I do put the violence in, and the way the women started to protect themselves, because they brought in things like the Cat and Mouse Act, which is when they would, you know, oh, you starve yourself in prison. What we'll do is we'll get to the point where you get really ill and you look like you're going to die. Then we'll let you go. Then you can fatten yourself up, be good again. And then once you're healthy enough to go back into prison, we'll rearrest you. And you can imagine what that does to a human body being constantly starved, yeah. let go, starved, let go. So it was called the cat and mouse act, like a cat playing with a mouse and just not letting it die. Yeah. And so in order to avoid arrest, you know, they employed bodyguards. And at the time, mixed martial arts was incredibly popular. So turn of the century, a guy called Edward Barton Wright started to, you know, he basically got people from Japan to come over. I'm just trying to think of one of their names off the top of my head, and I didn't revise for this, but brought people from Japan over with, you know, different styles. So they did a mixture of cravat, which is type of wrestling, schwingen, which is type of club work. They did jiu-jitsu, and they did, you know, judo was just starting up, so they were sort of doing this sort of thing. And Edward Barton Wright invented a mixed martial art called Bartitsu, which Sherlock Holmes fans, we'll get back to Arthur Conan Doyle, would know, because that is the move. I think it was Tominagi, the actual throw that Sherlock Holmes uses to get rid of Moriarty on the waterfall. So that is, so he actually quotes it. I think he gets it wrong. I think he calls it Baritsu, but it was called Bartitsu.
Where did the name come from? I don't know. You haven't
Well, Edward Barton Wright. Edward Barton Wright is the Bart part, and Itsu is jujitsu. So he called it Bartitsu, which is just, you know, and Bartitsu does sound amusing. It sounds like something that you do on a Saturday night.
Oh my God, it's a Soho cocktail
exactly.
bar. I want to go there. Exactly. Bartitsu.
But yeah, so the trouble is that in order for all this to work, it's, you know, Sherlock Holmes martial art, you need to have things around you like a cloak, like a long walking stick and all these things that a gentleman had, pocket watch even, that you can actually use in self-defense. And this woman called Edith Garrard, who was tiny. She was 4'11". So, oh. you know, literally you could walk under a table with a top hat on and be fine, right? Really small. And she was like, well, I don't have these weapons, but I really love martial arts, because why wouldn't she? And she started to sort of train and learn how to deal with, you know, using what women have. So we very small, lots of hip throws, lots of shoulder throws, lots of using Indian clubs, to sort of, you know, give space and that sort of thing, speed weapons and that sort of stuff. And she invented this sort of, you know, mixed martial arts style for the suffragettes. She called it jiu-jitsu because most of it was jiu-jitsu, but some of it did involve strikes and everything else. So it was, so she started and she trained the suffragette bodyguard, as well as doing things like, she used to get pressed by doing sort of demos. So she'd go along to a theatre and throw police officers on the ground and show that it was possible for, you know, a small woman to defeat a large man, which it is. Well, you have to be very
right
skilled
news,
and
guess,
know what
yeah.
you're doing. Mm. But I mean, and remember, all of the police officers were over 6 foot at this time, because they're all ex-army, and they were all just trained to be violent and very bludgeony. And the good thing about being bludgeony is that you're not like doing sort of quick jab crosses and that sort of thing. They're sort of big hits and swings. So it's possible to actually get close to them. And once you're close to them, they're doomed. But it's just surviving the first onslaught.
I saw this photographic exhibition online not so long ago. I can't remember where it was, but it was showing spot. It was, you know, comparing photographs of the suffragettes in location with the location that they were in now or something like that. But it just sort of strikes me, and that's one thing I do love, and we you know, stayed mainly in this country for this episode, which is great. Well, actually we've been to Fiji, we've been to Greece kind of, but
I am well traveled, that was gonna
be my next question. But what I do love particularly about being here is being that close to history, you know, having these incredible museums and landmarks and buildings, and even your Reading Amphitheatre, whatever that is, don't tell me I'm not going to go there. No, I'm sure it's wonderful. That really excites me. And that's one thing, apart from the weather, you know, I absolutely love about living here in the UK, is that's history and sense of time and place that, you know, that does surround us. But that was going to be my next question. You're well traveled. Tell me about that.
Well, mainly as a child, because I'm a It's very difficult to. I mean, four parents, 6 brothers and sisters, but I am an only child.
Right.
And my so I've got half of my family Moroccan, half of my family Australian. And so when I was a kid, I think the first time I flew all the way to Sydney by myself, I was 6. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's so I've also, when I was about 12, I flew from Australia and I went round to meet my dad in LA. So I crossed the international date line. Now, I had 2 Tuesdays in a row.
Fantastic.
And I didn't fly back the other way. So I don't understand how today, if it weren't for me, today would be the day after it is. It would be Thursday.
I think you're obviously living in the future.
I'm living in, yeah. I'm living in the past. I'm living in the past by 1 day. And yeah. I had 2 Tuesdays.
So ironic, given that, your passion for history.
Exactly. I'm a day behind where I ought to be, but
you flew to Australia on your own at 6 years old. Why?
Yeah.
You were apologizing for being white as a toilet, in your own words.
Yes.
And obviously it doesn't change the color of your skin.
I mean,
you're quite international.
Yes, but I am quite, you know, I've been to mosque this year, you know, that's the...
Right.
I'm not a good Muslim, I will have a bacon sandwich with a hangover. But, you know, there's that side of one side of the family. So basically, when I was a kid, parents split up. So my mum fell in love and has a husband now who is Scottish, but had a family in Australia. So his family were in Australia. So he used to go there. She used to go with him. And so my dad would have me for half the holidays and then would send me over. So I'd get on a plane. I wouldn't be allowed off the plane when you stop off. So you either stop off in Hong Kong, Bangkok or Singapore, but I was an unaccompanied minor. So you're forced to stay on the plane. And also at the age of 6, I remember I was terrified of the plane toilets. The only part of air travel I couldn't stand was the plane toilet. So I didn't go to the loo. I think it was a 26 or 27 hour flight. So apparently I was grey when I got off.
I don't know if it's a myth. I still don't know at my grand old age and as a travel professional about don't flush the loo if you're sitting on it because you will get stuck or sucked down it or something. That was the whole myth.
I don't think you'll get sucked out the plane, but I do believe that they operate on a suction so you could damage yourself a little bit. I don't think you're going to get pulled out by your arse. I think you'll be fine.
It'd be embarrassing in the Darwin Awards, you know, nicely tied into Darwin. But 6 years old. I mean, I've got a 7-year-old right now. He's never been to the corner shop on his own, let alone, you know, on a plane to Australia.
I think it was quite stressful for my parents, but on the other hand, it was less stressful than traveling with me to get there. So
I think
it was, you know, you put your trust in, I think it was Qantas, but you know, you just do. It was a lot. I used to travel quite a lot because the going around the world the other way was by myself as well. So going from Sydney over to LA, that was a single flight as well. So
what was happening when you got to Australia at age 6? No, I mean, not. I was going to say literally, like you're not getting off the plane, but
party time.
Yeah, exactly.
It was. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, they were there at the airport. They didn't say, "Izzy, can you just rent yourself a car?" That didn't happen. they were like, "Oh, hello, there you are, child. Well done, you made it." So I had family in Brisbane. Actually, I have family for those Australians listening who understand this. I have family in Gympie. That is, you know, the Castlemaine 4X on the train,
the train
on the front, that goes to Gympie.
Right.
And that is the most famous thing about Gympie.
That sounds amazing. The routes in and out of it are really good.
it's a beautiful place, but it is quite quiet. So basically my stepfather had a bit of work in Melbourne and Brisbane. So I went to school there for a little bit. I used to have an Australian accent. And because my parents are very well travelled, I stayed for a long time in Hong Kong once. And I think, when you're a kid, you don't really know. And I think it was a couple of weeks, maybe something like that. But I definitely had to go to school with a girl called Amber for a couple of days. And that was all in Cantonese. So I was completely lost. First time I saw Star Wars, I was in Hong Kong. And I watched Star Wars on video. And it was in Mandarin with Cantonese subtitles.
Did it make any sense?
It made perfect sense.
Yeah,
it's
exactly,
a very well-cut film.
I understood
exactly what was going on. I understood who was good, who was bad, just by the music and the intonation. But it was a strange sort of childhood. So I spent a lot of it, you know, there obviously, you know, it comes from, you know, a very privileged childhood. You know, you can't really sort of say, I got to feel sorry for me, you know.
Yeah.
My childhood was so sad, the air miles, the constant travel. But I did get to see a lot of the world. So I got to see places like Bali and Thailand. And it was incredible, just because if you're going all the way to Australia to see your siblings, you're going to stop off in these places because it doesn't cost much more. And you get to see these, you know, amazing places. And my parents are very social people, so they all had friends there. We hardly ever stayed in hotels and stuff. So it was always, you know, an exciting, you know, experience. Just
that's so glamorous and exciting, you know, particularly what most of us were doing in primary school.
Well, exactly. I remember being sat in Bali on the toilet. When I say sat on the toilet, hovering. and this is one, what do you remember about Bali? I went to see like beautiful puppet shows and I saw the beautiful beaches and we had coconuts, you know, drinking straight out of coconuts. And we went to these amazing temples. We had monkeys that climbed at you in order to get the, you know, the peanuts that you bought for them and that sort of thing. All of that. Now, the main memory I have of it was being squatting on this toilet and in under fluorescent lights with bad diarrhea, because obviously you do. And as I was, you know, unable to move, a dead bat moved across the floor being carried by ants in front of me. And there was nothing I could do. And it's just the decomposed dead bat being moved in front of me by all these bugs whilst I'm not feeling very well. That's my, you know, abiding memory of Bali.
It's a good job there's no trip advisor back in those days, because it would make a great review.
Fortunately, my spelling wasn't very good back then, so it wouldn't have made much sense. But it is.
That must have really shaped you. You know, that's given you such an independence early on. But you haven't explained the Moroccan, and in fact, going to the mosque as well. But you haven't explained the Moroccan side of it.
Oh, the Moroccan side. I have my mother on my father's side, as it were. So my stepmother is she's Moroccan, born in Morocco, came over when she was, I think, 14, lived in Trowbridge. And then moved to London, got married at 16, had her first kid at 16. So she's, you know, much younger than my mother for that reason. And she divorced, fell in love with my dad. They've been sort of living together, finally got married just after the pandemic. So I can now officially say, exactly, it was very romantic. It was very sweet. So now they're officially married. So I get to basically claim my siblings as mine now. They can't deny me.
Oh,
as
that's
the,
so lovely.
You know, uncle white lady who is there.
Don't apologise for yourself. You're okay, Izzy. You're all right. You know, you're
I'm fabulous. I'm fabulous. Yes, I am exactly. But I do stand out because, you know, Moroccans and me, because I'm 6 foot as well. Right. So there's no hiding. You know, there's no sort of get in line with the other children and don't try and, yeah, I'm big.
Where have you felt most out of place in the world, or standing? Ooh, when have you stood out most?
That is interesting. To be honest, where you're from, to Brighton.
Yeah.
Because I used to live in Brighton for a bit when I was a kid. My mum lived in Brighton and I used to travel down at the weekends, and I had I bleach it now, but when I was a kid I had bright white hair, and Japanese tourists would find me and photograph me, you know, the way that people photograph other people's children. Look at the way these strange foreigners live, and look how foreign they look. And so I was always sort of brought out, you know, because bright white hair, dark eyebrows, dark eyes, sort of looking really strange. And yeah, Japanese people used to take my photo a lot. I might have my own dedicated website out there. I really might. But every time I went down to Brighton Beach, I'd have my photo taken by strangers. Presumably not in a bad way. I don't know if people would get away with that now, but it was the 90s, so nobody cared.
We do it, don't we? To, like, you know, African kids running through fields,
exactly.
Or Indian kids living, you know, in...
Yes, living the
Mumbai
sort of slums.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Instagram life, and you're just like, that's not great.
They're doing the same. I always wonder, do you ever wonder, like, how many people's photographs you're in? And I was wondering if it'd be possible to do, like, to search all the computers in the world for Face ID and see, like, how many you, not just people are taking photos and touching your hair and stuff, being a tall blonde person, but you know, in the background at the Coliseum or in whatever that place is in Reading. And,
it's not just it's usually just you and a squirrel, to be fair. It's not crowded there. But I think AI was going to be able to do that, because like my photos now automatically find my friends' faces and tags them. And it's really freaky when it does that. But I'm sure that that's coming, because I mean, I believe the Chinese government do that already with their citizens. They have face recognition technology and everything, so they can track people and find them quite easily. Not less sinister than that, maybe, but
to find you in your family, in people's family photos. That's what I was thinking. Yes, I suppose it obviously exactly. It's got a bit more useful uses than that to the nefarious.
Useful for regimes. Yes. But yeah, no, it's interesting. I think we're, you know, I'll tell you what, we're in a hell of a lot more than we would have been 100 years ago. So, you know, there's going to be a lot more photos of us probably, you know, in the last day or two than there would have been in our entire lifetimes 100 years ago.
So. And it affects your memories as well, doesn't it? Because I've got memories of childhood that, you know, we didn't take that many photos, but that are aligned to and intertwined with those photos. And my kids have photos, you know, a good 30 or 40 every day, sometimes every hour when they were babies. I wonder how it's going to affect our memories, and actually bringing it back to what we've been talking about a little bit, the memories of history, because of course everything is captured now. I was going to say less easy to edit, but of course it's still easy to edit and see it through the eyes of who is recording it, I guess.
I mean, that's the trouble with any sort of photo, is you're looking at it through the people who are thinking what's, you know, it's the thing with any bit of history, any written history, it's what people think is important is what gets preserved and what gets passed down, which is
why we've got loads of white pirates.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's why we've got loads. I mean, there were loads of white pirates but you know what I mean?
It's why we don't have any black ones.
Yeah, it was why the black ones' names aren't remembered. Pretty much all the black pirates, and there's several of them called Black Caesar. Right. And they were all different pirates over different periods, but, you know, their name is Caesar, so they got called Black Caesar because they are black and that's a fun name, you know. And yeah, and they don't have their records, you know, as deeply explored because they're not seen as important, which is the same with almost all the women in history. It's just like
all the women.
Well, like Richard Owens, who I was talking about with the dinosaurs, he came up with the word dinosaur, but he ripped off a load of research by a guy called Hilary Mantel, who was amazing. He was the guy who discovered the iguanodon, and he worked out, you know, the ones with the thumb spikes. And the story is he found these teeth and he realized that these teeth looked like giant iguana teeth. But he didn't find those teeth. His wife, Mary, found those teeth.
Mary, down on in Dorset, isn't it? Mary, what's her name?
No, you're thinking Mary Anning.
But oh, I assume Mary. Right,
yeah,
okay.
Different Mary. But,
common name at the time.
Lots of women in paleontology, you know, some of them are called Mary. But she found the teeth. She is the one who gave them to him, says, I think these look interesting. You know, all of these people are in these stories who just don't get mentioned because the story has to be about the man and about the, because that's the narrative that Victorian women were told, is you have to, you know, you read these biographies of men in Victorian era, so they don't mention having a family. They don't mention their children or their wives or anything like that, because that wasn't the story they wanted to present. You know, what they present is this. Yeah, it's the same with the Arcadian kings. You know, it's the same with, you know, when you have a society which is very, you know, this is, you know, the example and this is the great people from history. It's a real sort of, it's the way we teach kids now as well in Key Stage 1 and 2. We sort of say, hey, it's this person from history. You could be like that person from history. You can change the world. But ultimately, none of these individuals change the world. The systems that they grow up in, that they kind of are spawned from, that caused them to be, are the things that change the world. And they are just sort of the label that's put on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like saying, well, Trump changed the world. And you're just like, did he? is that something else? It's like saying Farage caused Brexit. You're just like, did he? Or is that something else? You know, there's bigger sort of underlying currents going on. I'm one of the sort of, you know, underlying people. But on the other hand, it's a great, I think it's so much easier for the human brain to understand an individual and their motives. It's so much more interesting for us because we are quite introspective and we quite like a good story about a person. And we like that sort of minutiae of decisions and why they did that and would I have done different? And I think it's that which grabs us, which is why we follow these big people. And if you've got a society which favours white men, you can't say these white men didn't do anything, because they did, and they are interesting. It's just that it's nice to see, to hear why they were there and the other stories that, you know, were around them and surrounding them.
Absolutely. There were other interesting people around at the same time.
Exactly.
And it'll be nice going forward to have everyone talked about and all views at the table if we can.
Well, exactly. And it is
or a more variety, I mean, a greater variety.
I mean, there's a lot to be ashamed about being British, but do remember that, you know, it was the British people, and when I say people, the rich white men who were landowning class who voted to say to end the slave trade.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the first country, the first peoples in history ever to say, let's do that. And then to put money behind it so that they went out and they stopped the trade happening. Literally men, you know, fought against, you know, people trying to trade slaves, sunk ships, died in the process of trying to do it. So I think there's that to be slightly proud of too.
You know, I feel like quoting Stevie Wonder actually, which will... which is not Stevie Wonder. It's Stevie, it's really awful, which will bring me up nicely to my last question, actually. But it was Stevie Wonder and Paul McCartney, wasn't it, that did Ebony and Ivory. But I'm thinking, people are the same wherever you guys are. It was really bad. It was kind of, I'm not going to sing. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to ask you last question.
You should definitely sing. You should sing now.
Again, I will. In my head, I am singing. And I hope you are too. I'm going to ask you my last question because it ties in really nicely, actually, because my last question is always about music. And I don't know, I think, I don't know if Sean Keaveney kind of did this when he started his own travel, but not travel. I adore travel and I'm a travel specialising journalist. But my first love is music. And if I was doing anything, it'd be Desert Island Discs. They're not going to hire me to do that. So I invented this instead. But I always think that music and travel go very much hand in hand. And if I had to ask you to name one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel, what is that song and what were you doing? What comes to mind?
Oh my goodness. To be honest, and this sounds, oh my God, this sounds weird. It was the Cruel Intentions soundtrack. Okay. And the Cruel Intentions, my dad decided, because he's the sort of man who has a lot of friends in Italy. So we drove down from London down to Italy, which is a long drive. And we had three albums on this. We had the Cruel Intentions soundtrack. We had OK Computer by Radiohead, because it's the only things that him and I could agree on. And I think we had Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon.
Nice.
And so forever, these three albums are completely ingrained in my brain with that sort of Italian countryside. Which, you know, and just looking out the window going, I'm 14 and this is awful. You know, I'm on my holiday with my dad.
Yeah, oh my exactly. God. Rolling your eyes.
Nothing to do. He keeps like bringing me around these weird Italian, and I can only say ciao. That's it. I can count up to 10 and that's, oh my God. And I have to speak to all, and there's these boys and it's, oh. So I was sort of doing my sulky teenager thing and we were driving through. But also like every time I see a Renaissance painting, because all of the Renaissance painters are inspired by Italy. So all of these things, we get Jesus walking through what you think of as like, you know, Nazareth and that sort of thing. Nazareth looks like Italy because that's the countryside that all these painters were painting because they were in Italy. And so I always think of, you know, when I see religious things, I always think of stuff like Dark Side of the Moon and, you know,
that's very atmospheric. Because, you know, as we record this, Dave Gilmore is like about 2 minutes down the road. Well, if he's in his side house, yeah, I could
That's
knock around
cool.
and tell him.
That's pretty cool.
What is on you the could... Cruel Intentions soundtrack, by the way?
I'm just trying to remember. It is there's one song, and I don't ask me to name list the sounds. It's we'll literally it. There's one song. Okay, she's an eight ball. She is a rolling faster than a white wall. Got an avalanche track. In a snowball, she's losing all the leeches I'm like dancing. A stone wall. That, there you go. There's that one. There's Secretly by Skunk and Nancy.
Oh yeah,
which is lovely. I like that one. There's Coffee and TV, I think, by Blur.
Nice, good
there's a few. There's a really, you know, it's a good one actually.
Yeah,
because you think this is going to be awful, but actually. There's quite a lot of good stuff, and actually, Cruel Intentions is quite a fun film. yeah. as well. And you and think of it as just like
as well, you know, especially
very teenage angst, but very, very sort of Shakespearean in its sort of good and bad and playing with morality. It's very and also just full of rich, you know, annoying teenagers, which, you know, I was probably one of them, but not
I love a rich, annoying teenager. Yeah. Totally aspired to be one of those. Never got to be. I'm sure it was annoying and a teenager. Yeah. But yeah.
I never got to the stage where I actually had any sort of branded clothes or jewellery. What? However, seriously? I did. No, that's not true. I had a pair of Nikes. I had a pair of Nike trainers. But I did go to a nice, you know, a public school. And I did, you know, hang around with those people. And when I say those people, they were lovely. And I used to tease
them. Yeah, of course. People are people. There is good and bad in everyone. Exactly. Is that it? It is Ebony Nabry. Anyway, I don't know. Izzy, thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
No worries.
It's really nice to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you too. And do Your Place or Mine with Sean Keaveney on BBC Sounds.
Boom. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure all my listeners love it already. Absolutely. We're all Big Six music fans, me and my friends as well.
Oh, well, there we go. Exactly. Yeah. And you can't, you know, think of that without Sean. So.
Thank you so much, Izzy, and to all of you for gracing us with your ears. If you enjoy what we do, please do go give us a nice review online somewhere and subscribe on an app so you get every episode sent to your handy little phony device or whatever you listen on. Thank you, and we'll be back very soon.